Attention crew, this is your Captain Caliban speaking. This is a supplemental episode of Enterprising Individuals, where we bring you news and tidbits from the world of Trek, also interviews with special guests, and a few little surprises along the way. I want to get right to it today because I've got a great pair of guests on the show today. Justine Mastin and Larissa Garski are back on the show to talk about their new book, Starship Therapies. Justine and Larissa are licensed marriage and family therapists, and they're big nerds, too, and they put that nerdiness to work in their work by harnessing the power and the narratives of fandom to promote growth and self-discovery. And they've got a new book called Starship Therapies, using therapeutic fan fiction to rewrite your life. It just came out this month, and in it, Justine and Larissa use characters and stories from movies, TV shows, comics, video games, anime, and more to provide techniques for self-care and understanding. What does Dolores think about the loops that she's trying to break out of? How does Link find the strength to fight Ganon? What's Heathcliff's actual deal, man? This book has the answers, and those answers can help you too. I encourage you to check out the book, and to that end, I've got an Amazon link in the show notes where you can do so, and you can read a sample of the book. Justine and Larissa have a podcast as well, also called Starship Therapies, where they discuss the same themes, and you can find that wherever you get your podcasts. I've also got links to where you can find more of their work in the show notes as well. And that's it from me. Enjoy my talk with Justine and Larissa. I'm okay, you're okay, but the Ferengi in the clown suit has to go, and with that, let's get underway. Joining me once again are Justine Mastin and Larissa Garski. Justine and Larissa are licensed marriage and family therapists, and on their podcast, Starship Therapies, they boldly explore all things pop culture, fandom, and psychology. Their new book is called Starship Therapies, using therapeutic fan fiction to rewrite your life, and it comes out on May 4th. Justine and Larissa, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having us back.
Yeah, we're very excited to be here.
It's great to have you back on the show, and I should note that that was Justine's voice first and Larissa's second. The last time that we talked was on Memorial Day last year, when the pandemic was in full swing and people were on lockdown. Wow. And not all that much has changed since then. There's been a lot more cases and deaths, but now there are several vaccines being distributed and a lot of the resistance against preventative methods has been quieted. But we're all, for the most part, still stuck inside. And I'm sure that for people who are already dealing with anxiety or depression, having a worldwide pandemic and being cut off from your loved ones isn't going to help that much.
No, it's been a real hard year for people.
Yeah.
All of the mental health providers that I know have just been maxed out with folks reaching out for help, which I'm so glad people are reaching out for help.
Yeah.
And now it's getting to be a little bit harder to find a therapist because so many therapists, their caseloads are just maxed out.
Yeah, they're at capacity.
Mm-hmm.
I know that many therapists are conducting online sessions with their clients, but are there other ways that the mental health profession has had to bend to fit pandemic life?
I can take that because I see Larissa thinking. Yes, we had to shift the way that we work.
Yeah.
In, you know, literal how we conduct therapy, but also we've really had to pivot around how to help people.
Yeah.
Because so many of the interventions that we would typically use involve inviting people to go do something, right?
Yeah.
You know, they're experiencing distress. Well, can you go see a friend? Or like what typically helps you when you're feeling anxious? Well, going to the movies. Okay.
Right. I mean, and even more like basic pieces in terms of being in session with folks, like fidgets and play and like in the moment interaction are a huge part of how both you and I do therapy, Justine. And we don't have access to that when we are either on the phone or doing video chatting. So it's been an opportunity to stretch, I suppose.
Sure.
And I found myself using a lot more like sending things to clients either via email or text in between sessions to like create a bridge. So like memes or GIFs have been really big,
sure.
Which like in the before times I would have been like, oh no, I want to be professional. But now I need to find other virtual ways to encourage and invite play. And that's one of the ways that I found is, you know, helpful.
Yeah. just maintaining that connection and like, yeah, I'm here. I'm here for you. And yeah, it's tough to feel isolated. I was thinking about life in mental health facilities as well. I mean, obviously being in a hospital or a clinical setting would mean that you can take extra precautions against spreading COVID, but you know, you've got family and friends coming to visit and you don't know if they're being responsible or what they might be bringing in. And once it gets into a residential facility, I mean, it could get anywhere.
Yeah. Luckily that's not the branch of mental health that Larissa and I are in. Yeah. But we do know folks who work in facilities, and it's been a tough time for folks, both the residents and the clinicians.
Yeah, sure. speaking of mental health facilities, I've been thinking lately about how they're depicted in media. And, you know, unsurprisingly, they're often not depicted accurately or sympathetically. Mm-hmm. Even now in the 21st century, there was a Steven Soderbergh movie from a few years ago called Unsane. And it had this totally hack premise of, you know, oh, this woman is committed to a mental health hospital, but she's not supposed to be there. And now she can't get out. And the staff is mean and neglectful. And the patients are all, you know, they're stock movie, quote unquote, crazy. And it was shocking to me that, I mean, I don't know if Steven Soderbergh is a guy who's really progressive or not, but to shoot and do a movie like that in the 21st century is just like, what's going on?
Our profession definitely is not portrayed in a positive light most of the time by movie and television, that's for sure.
It's too bad too, because you know, a lot of people only see mental health care facilities and therapy in media and entertainment, and if the time comes where their loved ones need that kind of care, they're immediately on their guard and they see it as something to be avoided at all costs.
Right. Yeah, I really wish that media were more committed to excuse the pun.
right.
To portraying more realistic images of all range of mental health. And you know, some is getting better, but the vast majority is just still tropes, right? Either therapists are in some way nefarious, you know, they're sleeping with their clients, or they're know, snooping predatory on their clients' personal lives. Like there was a show on Netflix called Gypsy that I think is probably the worst depiction of a therapist I've ever seen. Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
Naomi Watts with her leather-bound book of notes that she brings with her all over New York City, just full of clients' protected health information. Just sitting there. She gets up and goes to the bathroom, and there it is, sitting on the bar for anyone to look at.
That's a real big HIPAA violation.
Yeah, right.
Right. So either therapists are in some way nefarious, or you know, they're bumbling, unhelpful. Such as 13 Reasons Why.
Oh, 13. Right. No, don't get me started. You know, it's one thing if it's like a heightened sort of reality, like something like Hannibal or something like that. But like 13 Reasons Why or as you mentioned, Gypsy, or even just anything like The Unsane, anything that's in like a real world where everything's supposed to work kind of how it works. But I guess you need it to be a certain way to make your story come off.
How are you possibly going to hold a client's attention with what a real therapy session looks like?
Right.
I mean, they did a good job of it in that Rick and Morty episode where it's the like the mashup of the family therapy session with why can't I think of it? Die Hard. Pickle Rick.
Oh, the pickle one.
Mm-hmm. Pickle
the
Rick.
Pickle one. Pickle sure, Rick. Sure. Yeah, that was an amazing depiction of family therapy. Genuinely.
To be fair, we had to get all through Pickle Rick to get like 3 minutes of the family therapy session.
Yeah, right.
That's true. Yeah. We had 30 seconds of the family and then 5 minutes of Pickle Rick. But nonetheless, that's probably the best show our field has gotten thus far in media.
And of course, like Rick as a character is so dismissive and hostile of therapy as a tool. And of course, he's depicted as like the hero who is always right on the show. So that kind of message isn't necessarily great for an audience either.
Doesn't he finally give in though at the end?
I think so.
I think so. I mean, the show's still going. If he was really like balanced as a person, maybe you wouldn't have a show. But I don't know if you guys saw the show recently. It was recently ended on FX, Legion.
I never watched it, but I would imagine, Larissa, you did, because that's an X-Men tie-in, right?
Yeah, it's an X-Men character.
I did. It, actually, I'm so disappointed in myself because I haven't finished it yet.
Oh,
I took a break early in the pandemic. It was just like too intense for me. But feel free to spoiler and I can react to
No, I don't. There's no need to spoiler. I really like the show, and just picking that character, that's a character who hasn't always been sort of positively portrayed in the comics. But I think the show was really committed to exploring mental health issues, not just in that character, but also in people who live these kind of lives, have these kind of powers. But even their mental hospital was like a weird off-putting prison that we see in like the first season.
It was, and it's odd. It didn't, that depiction of mental health facilities didn't bother me as much as some, because I felt like the show did a very good job of saying, of making it clear that they weren't trying to portray something realistic. They were trying to use art and comic book language and visual presentation to like give you the feeling of what it was like to be Legion in that facility, rather than like, here is an honest and accurate depiction of therapy with John Stamos in the Netflix series You, right? So the fact that it wasn't going for that realistic vibe, I was able to go with it, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And that's a character who is, I guess, depending on where you are in the real world timeline, depicted as being a multiple personality or a schizophrenic or something. But I like the idea of them exploring somebody who is, from a nerd perspective, like a telepath, but doesn't know it necessarily. And so is having thoughts and hearing voices that aren't necessarily theirs, and how you would deal with that in kind of a real world scenario.
Well, and in that, I mean, I'm really glad that you're bringing this up, because, I mean, while I don't want to speak for Justine, but I don't work with any people who are actually telepathic. but I do work with people who are very emotionally sensitive or attuned. And what I mean by that is that they are able to pick up on the feelings of others around them. And it can be a very confusing experience, especially if they're younger, because they aren't able to always tell what feeling is theirs, what feeling is someone else. And so then part of my work with them is learning how to differentiate, and then how to kind of like build up protective internal boundaries, so you're not taking in every single emotion that's sort of floating around you, which is somewhat similar to what Legion goes through in terms of just like picking up people's thoughts and identities and not knowing whose was his and whose was someone else's and what was the schizophrenia.
Yeah. Well, just connecting it back to Trek, I'm trying to think of mental health care facilities that we see in Star Trek. And there's a couple. I mean, there's the alien hospital that Riker lands in, or doesn't, in Frame of Mind. It's not a great depiction of a mental health care facility, but it is on an alien planet. And the point of the episode is the fear and the paranoia that Riker is experiencing in the experience. There's, of course, Elba 2, From Whom Gods Destroy, where they've got Garth of Izar stashed. And that's just like a 60s TV depiction of a, you know, quote unquote, loony bin. The only thing they're missing in it is a guy who thinks he's Napoleon. But they've got that covered by calling it Elba 2, I suppose.
I suppose so. Is this one from the original Star Trek series that you're referring to?
Yeah, okay. Right. And there's the Tantalus penal colony from Dagger of the Mind, which is one of my favorite TOS episodes, but not because of its depiction of mental health. It's a facility that's not specifically for mental health treatment, but it's for housing the criminally insane. And you've got a doctor experimenting on patients to, you know, quote unquote, fix them.
Don't love that.
Yeah.
Hard pass now.
Yeah, Gene Roddenberry and his writers were futurists, but they weren't mental health professionals. And it seems like they, at least in their scripts for the show, bought into the idea that in the future, you know, superior technology would, quote unquote, fix deviant minds. You hit them with a sanity laser, you know, or something like that.
Right. Get them that hypo spray, that anti-anxiety, anti-depression hypo spray, and you're good to go.
Yeah, just get that. Yeah, once a day. So, like, just from your own perspectives as professionals and Star Trek geeks, you know, barring the discovery of the sanity laser in the future, what do you think mental health facilities would look like in the future of the Federation?
Oh, wow. I love this question.
I can see your brain just bubbling with ideas. again, not a telepath, but
someone keep who's in mind, very attuned.
Yeah, but yeah. Attuned.
You know, we're looking at theoretically like unlimited resources and unlimited space.
Sure.
You wouldn't want to ghettoize patients, but you could have like a really nice planet, you know, where you could just send people to recover.
Yeah, and I guess like I would envision it being really focused on recovery and a lot of group therapy.
Yeah.
A lot of very early on helping people learn how to de-escalate intense emotions, learn how to identify what feelings are theirs, what feelings are others. And also a society that was built around and had the means to really measure and assess and quantify feelings, which we don't really have now. Like we know that feelings exist and have a huge impact on folks, but it's very hard to measure them, which is part of why in our present time, you know, insurance really loves therapeutic approaches that are focused on behaviors because we can measure behaviors.
Quantify them, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But emotions are tougher. And so I would imagine in Star Trek, we would have those abilities to measure, to assess, to have early detection such that, you know, you maybe wouldn't see, like Justine and I both don't like this, this identifier, but it is what we currently use in the mental health field. I would imagine you wouldn't see something like a personality disorder, which is the result of severe persistent trauma, often at a very young age. Mm-hmm. And in the future, we would be able to, you know, identify and catch that very early on and make sure that that person got the healing and the support that they needed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that. And I imagine in this future, because we have folks like Deanna Troi, right? Mm-hmm. We have counselors on the bridge of starships. So clearly mental health is something that we talk about. It's part of the culture. It's part of the, you know, the social consciousness. Yeah. That mm-hmm. that there's not this stigma around it, right?
Mm-hmm.
You go in for your little kid checkup at the at the space dock, and you know, they're checking for medical illness and they're checking your mental health as well, and it's all it's all neutral, right?
Yes.
Right.
And then it's assessed, like, what do you need? Well, maybe you need to go to Planet Chill for a little while.
Planet Chill.
And nobody thinks that's a problem. They're like, oh yeah, mm-hmm. I was on Planet Chill when I was 15. Oh, cool. I was there when I was 22.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Lots of like openness in terms of dialogue, emotional mm-hmm. vulnerability. I think they actually do a pretty decent job of attempting to depict that in this most recent season of Star Trek Discovery.
Uh-huh.
The Doctor, though it's not named in the series, the Doctor very much has this therapeutic approach for different crew members when needed. And so he is able, when they come into sick bay, like he does the usual like physical medical assessments, but he's also assessing for, you know, like emotional volatility and mental health and all of that. And so he brings that into the work and how he treats his patients and works with fellow crew members. And I would imagine that that too would be part of the Star Trek future, this very integrated approach to what health and wellness and medical treatment looks like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's Dr. Culber mm-hmm. on the show. That's sort of become his role in a lot of ways, as not the chief medical officer, but also maybe just the mind guy who's kind of assessing people. But of course, then we've got in season two, we see, you know, Spock in his cell at the Federation Hospital, and he's got, you know, the crazy writing all over the walls. And so still some kind of regressive depictions on Discovery. You know, Trek is... We're talking about Discovery, you know, Trek's at the forefront of representation and has been for so long for so many important social topics. And I think it's been instrumental in the discussion of them. I mean, you guys are writing a book called Starship Therapize.
Yeah.
And for that reason, I'd really like to see the franchise like get up to speed on showing mental health care in a positive, progressive light.
We would like to see that too.
Yes, we would.
And
we
if really they would like to call us to consult,
we're ready.
Yeah, right. Well, you heard it here. you were talking about Discovery before, and Discovery Season 3 is really interesting. We definitely see characters dealing with psychological issues mm-hmm. and, you know, the idea that being Star Trekkers is rough on somebody's psyche.
Yeah.
And it's really explored in that season. We see characters struggling with separation from their loved ones once they reach the future. Mm-hmm. Kayla Detmer is specifically dealing with injury and post-traumatic stress. And the new character that we see, the Andorian Rin, is recovering from physical and emotional abuse and torture. And we've got the fascinating character, Sukal. Like, the entire season revolves around this character who is trapped in this artificial world and has unresolved grief and abandonment issues. Right. And if you're thinking about a second book, I'd have to imagine that Disco Season 3 is going to be in it a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and it was such an interesting thing for me when I was watching those final couple of seasons or final couple of episodes in season three with Saru and Sukal, and the way that Saru is attempting to really connect, but in a way that is very slow and compassionate. Like, it really resonated for me thinking about sessions I've had with clients who are struggling with severe and persistent trauma. Mm-hmm. And I thought they did in many ways a very authentic portrayal of how you would need to move with someone who is struggling with that much pain. My only critique would be that the ending kind of wrapped it up with this neat, beautiful bow. Like, look, Saru takes them back to their home planet, and now we're reintegrating into society. And as a therapist, I was like, well, I don't know if it would be that.
Right, right.
That easy and clear cut, but I appreciate that, you know, some of these are things that are the limits of storytelling.
It's going to be a long period of adjustment. He's going to be asking people on the street to tell him stories for a while still, I think.
Yeah, I think that's very true.
Yeah. I have to say, I haven't watched Disco yet, much to Larissa's chagrin. It's on my list.
It's okay.
But as we're talking about this, it does make me think of Picard and how Jean-Luc himself and all of his, you know, merry band of crewmates really could have done with picking up a marriage and family therapist along with
right, who also had experience dealing with persistent addiction issues.
Yeah,
that
definitely
would have been a lovely fit.
Right,
that ragtag team.
We've got one more person to pick up on Freehold. Let me just stop in at this clinic and I'd like you all to meet. Yeah.
Maybe for season two.
Yeah, that'll be in season two for sure. We also see in season three of Disco a rehabilitation of sorts of the character of Empress Georgiou. And I guess in that era, this is right about the time, maybe they could have used the mental health laser to cure her psychopathy. But instead, the Guardian of Forever gets involved, and we see some of her tragedies and regrets played out for us on screen. And the last time that you guys were on, we talked about the holodeck as a therapeutic device. Mm. And that's kind of what's happening in these episodes. If this was the 24th century, we would have played this out in a virtual environment. But instead, we get a pocket universe where Georgiou can confront her past and her regrets.
That was such a beautiful episode. And one of my favorite parts of it is that Georgiou doesn't get the change that she's seeking.
Yeah, yeah.
She doesn't get to change the outcome, but she is able to connect in new and different ways, in particular with Saru, which is interesting because in previous seasons, like, Georgiou was very dismissive of him. She viewed him as just walking, talking meal, basically. But it's her connection with him when she goes kind of back in time into the mirror universe that really shifts things.
Yeah, and plus, like, getting the result that she wanted wouldn't be important for her therapy, I don't think, because she's so her kind of megalomania, you know, and her need to control things and express power, that
so well said.
Feeling that powerlessness, I think, is important for her. Yeah,
absolutely. And it, I mean, in some ways, it really mirrors what can happen in certain kinds of therapeutic modalities like EMDR or like internal family systems, where the therapist helps the client go back in and really re-experience some of those painful, traumatic events, but in such a way that from an emotional standpoint, the client can notice different things and can give this past version of themselves some healing, some compassion, some understanding that then helps them move through and in some ways transcend that pain and come out of those series of therapeutic experiences changed in a more positive way, which happens for Georgiou for sure.
Yeah, trying to close that empathy gap a little. Mm-hmm. There's a Section 31 series in development currently that will have Philippa Georgiou in the lead. How do you see a reformed Georgiou executing her duties in Section 31? And I wasn't implying anything with executing.
I mean, I think you were though, Aaron. I'm tentatively very optimistic about this show. I love Giorgio. I love Michelle Yao. I think this has just been such a wonderful as a viewer opportunity to see her sink into this role that has so much complexity. My hunch is that she's really going to struggle because I think she's going to be back in this system that no longer fully resonates with her. And yeah. So my hunch is you're going to see her as a free agent trying to figure out how do I enact change in a system that I now realize is so problematic. And, you know, maybe Giorgio will have access to our book, Starship Therapies, because our book talks about how as an individual you can start to enact change in a system that feels so big and so overwhelming.
They will have our book in the future.
Yeah, it's right. Got to be. It's in the Federation Library for sure. Yeah. Well, let's talk about your book, Starship Therapies, Using Therapeutic Fan Fiction to Rewrite Your Life. We spoke last time you were on about the ideas behind narrative therapy, but can you talk about how your book expands on the topic specifically?
Yeah. So, narrative therapy is sort of the crux of what we do. And we felt like, you know, White and Epstein, the dudes that came up with narrative therapy, did a great job. And also we would add a few things.
Okay.
And one of the big aspects we talk about in our daily work and in the book is play and the importance of play. Mm. And for us, play is fandom. And we are constantly writing fanfic in fandom, right?
Sure,
It's kind of impossible to watch something and not have some headcanon, right? Even if you aren't a person that sits in your room at night, like,
writing volumes.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, reams of Riker fanfic.
I feel very called out, and I'll acknowledge it.
We all do this where we look at the story and we go, you know what would be so good?
Yeah.
If dot, dot, dot. And what we're inviting folks to do is to look at their lives that same way. So to look at the story of your life and go, what if I made this decision?
Yeah.
What if I recast my, you know, this person who is actually causing me a lot of distress, do I need that character?
Okay.
Or like, do I want the relationship I have with this character?
Right. Yeah. I didn't mean to imply that we are like throwing people off bridges.
No, that's certainly not. This is not the Section 31 version of our book. This is the main universe one.
A black cover. Yeah.
Lots of gray overtones. but yeah, it's really about, as Justine is saying, using the powers of fan fiction and that creativity, that spark, that play, that sense of feeling like there's so many different possibilities and helping folks to see you can transfer that into your daily life. And part of how you transfer it into your daily life is figuring out, you know, using the characters that resonate for you so much and learning how to channel their powers, their abilities, their presence, their focus into the situations or the relationships or the roles in your present life that you want to start to shift, that you want to start to change.
Sure. Would you describe the book as self-help?
Yes.
Yes.
Well, I would. I saw Larissa thinking about that.
Well, sure. I have a tough relationship with self-help books because when I initially think of them, I think of them as being a bit like condescending or pandering and like not fun.
Sure, that's fair. So we created a new genre is what you're saying.
Yes, I feel like we have like a playful, fun self-help book because it is, it's playful, it's fun. We have these amazing fan fiction case studies that helps clients think and approach therapy and do in different ways. We have guided meditation. We have guided yoga in the book. So it really does invite a lot of playfulness as opposed to many of the self-help books that I've encountered are like, get up and drink water and think a positive thought to yourself.
Yeah, right. 101 things you can do to, yeah.
Yeah, that's fair.
if that works for you, beautiful.
Sure.
But if
sure.
If it doesn't work for you, then you know this is the book for you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And sort of a choose your own adventure.
Yeah. Sure. Yes. Mm-hmm. But not officially, because you guys get sued.
Correct.
Well,
it's
said,
like
sir.
That, but
it's
not
like
that.
But not that.
In your book, you have a wide swath of fandoms represented, from Star Trek to Star Wars, Harry Potter, comics, Westworld, Buffy, video games, even Wuthering Heights. And a lot of the characters in those stories have positive lessons for us. For example, like Frodo and Sam can teach us a lot about perseverance and trust and non-toxic masculinity. But do you ever find that you're using examples in an antithetical way? Like Bruce Wayne was traumatized by the death of his parents, but maybe funneling that pain into a career of beating people up at night is not the way to deal with loss?
I love this question. And I'm trying to think if we talk about it in the book, because we definitely talk about this IRL.
Yeah.
One of the fandoms that we talk about a lot, because it's one of my chief fandoms, is Supernatural.
And, oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yes. Right. And so we do talk about how, like, especially Dean's got some real what we in our industry would call maladaptive coping.
Yeah.
Right. Like, if you just watch the show, and if you are, I don't know, a regular old fandom, like, not that there is that in Supernatural, but if you were just, you know, a laissez-faire viewer, you were like, oh, look, Dean likes pie and waitresses and beer.
Right.
This is fine. Totally
this is
cool.
Fine, right?
All in moderation. Yeah.
Right. And we kind of dig into it and we're like, yeah, those things serve him in some ways.
Yeah.
But in other ways, wow, he's really avoiding feeling his feelings.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That, mm-hmm. you know, this could really be channeled in a different direction. And, you know, there's nothing inherently wrong with pie or waitresses.
So true.
But when we are using these tools as a way to mask our pain,
yeah,
then, you know, maybe we're running from something, hiding from something. So we do a little bit of that kind of work.
Yeah.
And we really dive right into that in the case study featuring Dean.
Yep.
Ah. A lot of my favorite characters, I guess when I think about it, are not doing a healthy thing with their traumas. Sure. My favorite comic book character is Daredevil, and he's not always depicted as the most balanced person. His vigilante activities often interfere with his civilian life. Not to mention the ethical questions of him being a lawyer, and he's often depicted as having very unhealthy relationships. So, you know, I admire him, but I wouldn't want to be him.
No, and we wrote a chapter for a book called Daredevil Psychology.
Oh,
yeah, where we talked.
I gotta check out that book.
Yeah, check it out. Where we wrote about the relationship with Stick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And how. How it's just kind of a confusing family dynamic for for poor Matt. He's never really had, you know, a real solid adult role model to show him how to, you know, make ethical choices.
Yeah. And he goes from a father who was sort of borderline abusive to a father figure who was just literally just wailing on him.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So fun.
Opportunities for learning. And also having characters that you can relate to, because maybe you've gone through some similar painful experiences.
Yeah.
And that can be the opening, the opportunity, the entryway into how to get your own healing. Like, you don't have to go the Matt Murdock route or the Dean Winchester route.
Right.
You can open yourself up to trusted community. You can learn how to say no to some of those caretaking impulses that you learned from both Dad and Stick, and find other ways and different kinds of ways to relate, and maybe improve your romantic relationships. Because if you relate to Matt Murdock hardcore, you probably could use some assistance there.
Okay, I'll look into that.
Oh, Aaron, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to like call you out, but I totally see how it's
a lot of unintended meaning today. There is a stereotype, I think, generally in the world of the nerdy or fanish type person as being lacking in social skills or being an introvert, turning to TV, comics, movies as an escape. I have an anime podcast, and on it we recently talked about the Japanese phenomenon of hikikomori,
right.
I think it's pronounced, which is people with acute social withdrawal who seek social isolation, who are often into anime and manga and video games to the exclusion of other things. And to be clear, not everybody who likes Doctor Who or whatever is seeking escape from the world. But do you think there's a connection between social anxiety or withdrawal and becoming absorbed in these fictional worlds?
I think there's a correlation, but not a causation. And I see Larissa maybe has a different take, which is great. You get two different opinions.
Sure.
Because the way that I see it is these worlds are welcoming of outsiders. Whereas the outside world is not always welcoming of outsiders. And the more outside we are, the more outside we feel, the more outside we become and loop and loop and loop, right? Mm-hmm. So if we feel like outsiders and we're looking for a place to feel at home, like I can speak from my own experience as a young human. My first fandom was Twin Peaks. I was much too young to be watching it.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
You're like, how old are you? Anyway, but part of what I loved about Twin Peaks, there were a lot of themes I didn't get when I was, 10?
Oh, yeah.
But I loved this idea of being both wonderful and strange.
Yeah.
That you can be both. And it was just this wonderful world I could go into. And liking Twin Peaks as a 10-year-old, like, that's not exactly a big banner that I'm wearing that's like, I'm cool. let's hang out.
Yeah.
You know, but these were worlds that accepted me. And the more I dove into them, the more I felt separate from others who didn't understand it. And then I think what happens is there becomes a confusion that looks like social awkwardness, but what it really is social misunderstanding. And we've talked about this, Larissa and I, that, you know, if you're standing at the water cooler and you're, you know, next to when we used to have offices with water coolers, and, you know, Joe Schmo from accounting is like, hey, did you see the game this weekend? And you, the nerd, are like, I don't know what you're talking about. I was at a joust this weekend. And Joe Schmo is like, I don't understand what you're saying. And it's not that the nerd is socially awkward. Mm-hmm. It's that there is a social misunderstanding because I don't understand sports and you don't understand the Renaissance Festival.
Right.
And one of those is socially acceptable and one of them isn't. Mm-hmm. Get down off my high horse now. I have a lot of feelings about the idea that all nerds are socially awkward.
And you communicated them so genuinely, like very clearly and coherently. Well done.
Thank you. What were your thoughts?
I mean, my thoughts were very, very similar to yours. And I'm over here thinking if I really want to add anything. I think the only piece I would add is to say that I think that fandom touches on something that is core to what it is to be a human being, mm-hmm. which is something that both Jung, and to a certain extent Freud, but it was mostly Jung here, mm-hmm. talked about Carl Jung being one of the founders of psychoanalysis and psychotherapy, which is the foundation of what we do now in mental health. Mm-hmm. He very much felt that as a human being, something that was core to us was the need to connect via spirituality, story, and some semblance of a higher power. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And part of how we do that is through fandom. And so rather than it being something that is like inherently aberrant or that inherently causes problems, I think folks who are really attracted to fandom that is their version of spirituality. That is often their version of religion. And can it become extreme and obsessive? Well, sure, but so can so many other fandoms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, religious and obsessive. I was thinking about football and right? The big game. So it's just another form of that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, as nerds and therapists in real life, writing this book is right up your personal and professional alleys. But was there anything that you really struggled with in bringing it all together? What was the toughest part of writing the book?
Proofreading. Yeah. The copy editing process.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's what you're asking.
Well, I'll take that answer.
I mean, I think for me, some of what was really hard was reminding myself this is just our first book.
Mm-hmm.
Because Larissa and I went back and forth a few times in certain areas where it was like, but I want to say this and we need to include this fandom and we have to do this. And we kind of had to just pull each other back and be like, hey, it's already 300 pages. That includes our references and notes
and art and all of that. Yes. Yeah.
Like we can't, we just can't. And it felt like for me anyway, sometimes like choosing a favorite pet, you know,
right? Sure.
Like who gets left out?
Yeah. Right?
And
yeah.
Is this the best example of this? Should we pull in this other thing?
Sure. We have this phrase that we use when we're writing, which is, do you want to die on this hill? And we would definitely do that when we were writing together because we write simultaneously. We write simultaneously in Google Docs. And so there would be things that there were definitely things that I wanted and then Justine wanted. And we would have to look at the other and be like, hey, do you want to die on this hill? This EDM hill, is this really where you want to stake your claim? And ultimately the answer was often no.
Yeah.
No, but every now and then it was like, yes, I will die on this hill. It's like, all right, okay, mm-hmm. Explain it to me. Explain to me why you die on this hill.
Yep.
You have to kill your babies.
I don't like that idea. I think it's more that like you take your baby and you're like, baby, you don't belong in this particular situation. So you gotta go over
the
here.
Kid does not stay in the picture.
You know, right? Like this is not for you. You're not gonna love this. And I would say the other really challenging thing about writing this book is that we wrote almost all of it during the pandemic.
Mm. Yeah.
And we had all these grand plans before the pandemic.
Oh, such wonderful plans.
About how we were going to like take time off and we were going to go somewhere warm and have a writer's retreat and none of that happened.
Sure.
And in fact, what happened instead is that we didn't really take any time off to write the book. So we were working like full time as clinical marriage and family therapists, seeing all of our clients and then finding hours within the week to write this book together. And so the emotional toll of that at times was definitely really, really draining. And there were even a few chapters, chapter 11 being the hardest one, at least for me, where we talk about the environment and the planet and all of these things that like, I did not want to write it because it brought up so much challenging stuff. And I remember saying to Justine so many times, I can't work on this right now. How would I be able to walk and do a session? And finally, Justine just had to look at me and she was like, listen, we're never going to be ready to write this chapter emotionally. It's never going to be a good time. This is like, we are carrying the ring to Mordor. This is where it's at. We just need to sit down and do it. And we did.
Right.
We did it together.
Yeah. And chapter 11 is pretty awesome.
It is.
Oh, good. Do each of you have a favorite meditation or exercise in the book or a particular subject that you enjoyed writing about? Justine?
Oh, I mean, being able to do the fan fiction case studies. Mm-hmm. That was pretty much like lifelong dream material right there.
Sure.
Being able to be so just to give listeners an idea here. Sure. In the book, we, Kirk and Spock, our alter egos, have harnessed the Vulcan mind meld in order to be a single therapist, to speak with a single voice.
Okay.
So in that way, we are both always in the session and we speak with one mind. But we get the opportunity to do therapy with Dean Winchester. Oh, just my dream.
Yes.
And Arya Stark, which is amazing. And then
Link
my
from Zelda.
Yeah, my other favorite though is
it's tough when he doesn't talk.
We made him talk.
Okay, all right, he's got to talk.
And we made a joke about it too for like folks who are like, "What in the world?" Yeah,
literally, his first line is, "Hi, I'm Link. I talk now." It's our world,
right?
But my other favorite fanfic case study is we did a text-based one as though we were in a chat room with a bunch of video game characters.
Okay.
And it's just it's group therapy.
Yeah.
With characters from video games, and it's just utterly delightful. Mm-hmm. And I truly cannot wait for people to read it. So that's my favorite.
It reminds me of the support group in Wreck-It Ralph, where all the video game characters are.
Yeah. Very similar to that.
Yep, similar vibe.
Larissa, how about you?
I mean, I feel like I share so many of the favorites with Justine. I too really, really love the case study where it's with the video game characters. We got the chance to personify May from Night in the Woods. And listeners, if you have not played Night in the Woods, I just really encourage you to do so. It is a fabulous indie game. So I really enjoyed that. And I would say it was a really hard chapter to write, but I think I'm most proud of chapter 2 and chapter 11. Both the hardest chapters. But they help the reader question social constructs, both learn how to notice those parts of systemic society that aren't working, like white privilege, and then give them tools to figure out then, okay, now that I've noticed this thing that is a social construct that isn't working for me. In the book, we call it a Westworld construct because it makes it more fun. But once I've noticed a Westworld construct, what happens next?
Mm-hmm. Oh, and I just remembered the case study with Gabbro.
Yeah.
Oh.
From
Outer Wilds, the video game. And then as a yoga teacher, I love all of the yoga sequences and meditations that we got to create.
Oh, we did hand magic for the magicians. I love that. Like yoga, it's so great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mudras, if there are any yogis in the listenership.
I'm familiar with Westworld, and as a show and as a narrative, I think it's got its problems. But I do like the idea of the hosts in the park and the way that their minds are sort of just splayed out for you to see, you know, the little iPad things that they have, and the way that they go through their loops, you know, and their sort of behaviors, which, you know, I clearly are meant as a sort of a metaphor for like human behavior and that sort of thing. Yeah. And they question their own identities and their you know, what they're really doing, you know, with their lives, such as they are in the park. I mean, it's like, it's one of those things where it's like, it's just an obvious metaphor, but it's like, I don't know. It just really works. I like that.
Yeah, it does. It's great.
Well, the book is Starship Therapies. It comes out on May 4th, and you can find more information about it at starshiptherapies.com. Remind people where they can find you online.
Folks can find me at blueboxcounseling.com or can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Mind Body Fandom, because I take a holistic approach to healing, mind, body, and fandom.
Great.
And you can find the our podcast, which we also have, called Starship Therapies, wherever podcasts are found. And we have our own website now, starshiptherapies.com.
I would say if you are interested in anything we said here today, go to our website, starshiptherapies.com. And if you want to hear my late night musings about Dragon Age, the video game series, you can follow me on Twitter at SpockSolliers.
I'm definitely going to check up on that. Thanks again for talking with me.
Thank you so much for having us back.
Thank you so much.
Hello, I'm Mikan Hana.
And I'm Caliban.
I am a huge Sailor Moon fan. I've been a Moonie since the beginning. I've seen every episode, every movie. I've read all the manga. I love it.
I've got a head full of bad wiring, and I've never seen a single episode.
Do you want to join the wonderful world of Sailor Moon?
Okay. Enter laughing. It's hard to believe that that was us. It feels like ancient history.
We recorded that a few minutes ago.
Ancient history. But now that I'm a Sailor Moon expert.
You're not an expert?
But I'm trying.
Every week on Sailor Noob, we talk about a new episode of the original Sailor Moon series.
It's all new to me.
And I'm a little more seasoned. I've been a Japanese language student and I've lived in Japan.
And you use your experiences to talk about the food, fashion, and culture of every episode of Sailor Moon.
What do you do again?
Share in the wonder of a classic anime series.
Good enough. Sailor Noob is a great companion for first-time watchers, and it is a fun hit of nostalgia for the experienced fan.
You can catch the show every Friday wherever you get your podcasts.
And you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr, posting all things Sailor Moon.
One day I shall be the master.
Let's just get through this series first.
Okay.